WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Larry McMurtry left his home state of Texas as a young man, but for the past decade, his fiction has helped shape the way Americans perceive the historic frontier. His Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Lonesome Dove, about a cattle drive near the end of the 1800s, was adapted into a very popular miniseries. His sequel, Streets of Laredo, was also made into a miniseries that ran earlier this month. McMurtry's new novel, Dead Man's Walk, is the prequel to Lonesome Dove. It follows the two main characters, Gus McCrae and Woodrow Call, in their early adventures as young Texas Rangers. McMurtry is making Dead Man's Walk into a miniseries, starring F. Murray Abraham and Keith Carradine. The Old West is just one of the subjects McMurtry has written about. He's also the author of The Last Picture Show and Terms of Endearment, which were adapted into films, and Horseman Pass By, which was the basis of the film HUD. He created the Lonesome Dove characters in the 70s when he wrote a screenplay for The Streets of Laredo. It looked like James Stewart, Henry Fonda, and John Wayne might star, but the movie wasn't produced.
Streets of Laredo, the script, was not a trail-driving story. It was a story of a kind of last adventure. It was kind of an end of the West story about a last adventure between three old guys or almost old guys who had been buddies throughout the sort of golden days of the Old West, had stumbled into this adventure, which was not successful, which is why the actors sort of drew away from it. Stuart Fonda and Wayne, they didn't want to be old, and they didn't want to be, if they were old and they were in an adventure, they wanted it to be a successful adventure, and it wasn't. So I got it back. I piddled with it for a considerable while. I didn't really write it until I wrote the screenplay in the early 70s. I didn't really write the novel until the mid-80s. And I suppose, of course, I come from ranching stock. I had nine uncles who were cattlemen. My father was a cattleman. Some of my uncles were old enough to participate a little bit in the last years of the trail driving era, which only lasted one generation. The reason there were trail drives is because there were no railroads to transport the cattle to market. As soon as there were railroads, it became very inefficient to drive cattle hundreds and thousands of miles, and of course they stopped. But the myth of the cowboy, as we have it today, came out of that roughly 20-year period, 20, 25 years, after the Civil War, in which the range cattle industry suddenly sort of flowered, kind of like the oil industry did a bit later, in which it was necessary to get all the cattle in South Texas, and millions of them, north to the markets. And it's very different from ranch life, which is not particularly romantic and not particularly cinematic. So most of the myth of the cowboy came out of that one generation of trail drivers, and it was perfectly possible, since cowboys were often very young, 13, 14, 15 years old. My uncles all left home before they were 14 and became cattlemen. Perfectly possible for one boy to have gone up the trail with the first herds in, say, the mid-60s, right after the Civil War, and the last herds in the mid-80s or a little bit later. So it was all over in a very brief period of time. And the fact that it lasted such a short while lent a certain romance and a certain poignancy to it.
Did your uncles ever talk about how dirty and smelly it was to ride with cattle?
Well, sure, they did. I mean, I grew up with cattle, so they didn't really have to tell me anything about dirty and smelly. They certainly are dirty and smelly. It's one reason I wouldn't have wanted to be a cowboy. Also, they're very stupid. I didn't want to be enslaved all my life to animals as stupid as cattle.
So you grew up on a cattle ranch?
Yeah, on a small ranch in north central Texas, just below the Red River, near a town called Wichita Falls, about 100 miles west of Dallas, Fort Worth, northwest.
Did your father expect you to keep on the ranch?
I think he might have liked it. It was evident pretty early that this was not going to be my skill. It was also, my father was not dumb, and he saw that the cattle business had already ceased to be a viable family business unless you own immense amounts of land, which we didn't. And even my uncles, who left home early and got to the Panhandle when it was open range and ended up with very substantial amounts of land, couldn't survive as ranchers. Ranching is an industry almost entirely supported by oil or by other money. You know, the ranchers now are doctors and lawyers and architects and people who have gotten rich in other professions. It's my father foresaw this as early as I can remember, which is by the mid-40s. He saw that the amount of land that we had would he made a decent living throughout his life. He was very, very skilled, but he was still in debt for 55 years. And he had four children. There's no way that if you divide that ranch by four that it can make a living for anybody. It wouldn't make a living for anybody even if it wasn't divided by four. And that was foreseen by my father very early on.
Larry McMurtry is my guest, and he's the author of Lonesome Dove, Streets of Laredo, the new book in the Lonesome Dove trilogy, Dead Man's Walk. He also wrote The Last Picture Show and Terms of Endearment. What was the life that you imagined you wanted when you were growing up in Texas, realizing that you wanted to get off the cattle ranch and you wanted to get out of the small town?
Well, I wanted a life in literature, essentially, and I realized that quite young. I didn't imagine that I would become a writer, but I knew that I could become a reader. And so reading has always drawn me from the age of five or six. It drew me out of the small town. It drew me to Houston, to Rice University. And it was sort of the strongest motivating factor for most of my youth. And as it turned out, like many readers, I began to try it for myself to see if I could do this thing that had given me so much pleasure. And I was lucky and successful. But it was reading that that took me off the range.
Were there bookstores around when you were growing up?
No, I had almost no books until I got to Rice. I did have a cousin who, as he was going off to war in 1941, I was like five at the time, stopped by the ranch house on his way to what turned out to be the Pacific Theater and left me some books, 19 books, in fact, just a bunch of sort of the normal boys' books of the time. And that was my library for quite a spell. There were some books in the high school library in Archer City, but not a whole lot. And I didn't really have adequate literary resources until I was a college student. Perhaps that's one reason I'm a rare bookseller as well as an author. And I have three rare bookstores, one in Washington, D.C., one in my hometown, and one in Tucson, Arizona.
When you started writing books about the Old West, was your idea to further the myth, to debunk the myth of the West, or revise the myths of the West?
You know, I didn't start really writing books about the Old West. I think Lonesome Dove was my 10th novel. Most of my books were set in the contemporary West, and still are. And in fact, in my fiction, I think I've written 19 novels, and one with my collaborator Diana Osana, and of those 19, only about four of them deal with the Old West. Mostly I've dealt with contemporary Western life, a la Terms of Endearment, a la The Last Picture Show, or the book called Horseman Passed By that became the movie HUD. I thought that the Western myth, or the myth of the cowboy, is very powerful. I thought that Lonesome Dove was, in a way, a critique of it. Because I grew up with cowboys. I respect them up to a point, but I'm not crazy about them. And I think something of their limitations, having grown up with them. So I didn't set out to write a book which glorified the myth of the West. I didn't particularly set out to write a book that debunked it either. You know, I was telling a story of three men who had been friends for a long time, who got caught up in an adventure, and the book was a description of that adventure and its consequences.
Give us an example of something in the story that you see as a critique of the myth of the West.
Well, for example, the scathing denunciation that Clara Allen makes of Captain Call when he arrives at her house with Gus's body, when she tells him why she didn't marry Gus, although he was her great love. because she didn't feel that she could hold Gus, that she didn't feel that there was any room for a woman in a domestic relationship in Gus and Carl's life. It's not that she felt that they hated women, it's just that they simply didn't give them their due. I think that's pretty severe, and that is redeemed to some extent in Streets of Laredo by the fact that Captain Call's old corporal, P.I., settles down and has a successful family life. But that didn't happen during the golden years of the Old West. This is a post-golden years story. It takes place, say, in the 1890s, almost the turn of the century. I think that's a true criticism. I think that women had a terrible time in the early West. Many of them went berserk, and I think that it was a masculine culture, maybe of necessity, but it was a masculine culture, and to some extent crude, to some extent fascistic, certainly not welcoming to women.
Well, one of the main characters in your series, Lorena, is, she's a prostitute during some
she's
of the
a, Yeah, she's a prostitute, and she's a whore in Lonesome Dove. And
she's kind of forced into it, really. I mean,
there's a character, strangely enough, in Dead Man's Walk, the book that's being filmed now. I just happened to see the dailies of this a couple of days ago when they're debating about, two men are talking about a woman named Matilda Jane Roberts, who was a whore known as the Great Western. And one of the characters remarks on her origin. She came into the West when she was 14, and both her parents died trying to get from St. Louis to Santa Fe or somewhere along the trail. And she became a whore to survive. And one of the characters says there wasn't no room for church-going women in the West in those days, just room for whores. And a lot of them didn't survive. And that's true enough. You know, my grandmother was a pioneer woman. And the West was sort of unsettleable until after around 1875, simply because the Indian Wars were still raging intensely. And my own grandparents paused in their Western migration at a safe line in Northwest Texas, and lived there for 10 years. They didn't go any farther west because they wouldn't have survived the Comanches, very likely, if they had. And then when the Comanches were finally subdued, more or less, in 1874, when their horse herd was destroyed, my grandparents went on to the place where they raised their family and where, in fact, I have the ranch house now, about 100 miles farther west into the Comancheria after it became safe.
Did your grandmother give you insights about what it was like to be a woman in the early days of Western settlement?
My grandmother, I don't remember my grandmother ever even speaking to me, although I lived with her. She lived in our house until she died, and I was a boy of 10 when she died. She had raised 12 children, lost two in a frontier. She was completely tired of children. She probably had 100 grandchildren by then, or between 50 and 100. She was used it up. I don't recall a single thing that my grandmother ever said to me.
Were you hurt? Sure.
No, I wasn't. I mean, it's only in the last few years that I've been looking back on that. Both my grandparents, and I mean, all four of my grandparents lived and died in the house that I was growing up in, and I had some relations with one grandfather, and that's about it. And I don't remember, because one of my grandmothers was substantially broken by the time I came into this world. And the other one wasn't broken, but she just sort of was through with children. I wasn't hurt at the time. I only reflect on it on that in the last few years that I really can't remember my McMurtry grandmother ever speaking a word to me. She must have, but I think it was more like get out of the way or shut the door or something like that. Certainly no stories ever came from her.
My guest is Larry McMurtry, author of the Lonesome Dove trilogy. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Larry McMurtry is my guest, and his books include Lonesome Dove, Streets of Laredo, and the new book in the Lonesome Dove series, Dead Man's Walk. He also wrote Terms of Endearment and The Last Picture Show. Did the place in Texas that you grew up in resemble the small town that you wrote about in the last picture show?
Well, it was. That's where the last picture show was filmed. I have the unusual circumstance of having seen one of my stories filmed in the place where it would have happened. The last picture show and Texasville were both filmed in the small town of Archer City, Texas, which is where I grew up. The town is now sort of slightly confused. It's been so much fiction touched on it. It doesn't really know whether it's fact or fiction. And sometimes when I go home, I feel like I'm living in my own theme park. You know, they have restaurants called Texasville, and it's rather odd. I've inundated that little town with fiction, and, you know, most people think that they must be some character in one of the books. They're not quite sure which, and yeah, it's unusual.
That's funny, because I think the reaction to The Last Picture Show was pretty bad when it was first published, the reaction in your town because of the sexuality in the book.
That's a little overblown, actually. That's because journalists have to have something to write about, and the Baptist minister, indeed, was offended by the movie and one or two other people in town. But, in fact, a lot of people in the town worked on the movie and saw what was happening. A lot of, and you know, even then, in 1971, it brought $3 or $4 million, it brought about, you know, $1 million into the town in a time like that. That county, which I suppose was cattle country when my grandparents stopped there in 1880, was definitely the oil patch by then, and it depends upon the fluctuations in oil prices, not cattle prices. And the cattle prices haven't amounted to anything for hardly in my lifetime, and I'm 60 years old. It's the oil patch, and when the oil business is up, it flourishes a little bit. But I've been buying building after building and putting, you know, books in them. The townspeople, I think, are slightly alarmed, but in fact, nobody but me wants those buildings. And, you know, the town is down to a hardware store and a drugstore. Hmm. Doesn't have a hospital anymore. And it has a couple of filling stations, a hardware store and a drugstore, you know, and an abstract company and a bank, and that's about it. And if there's any other services in Archer City, they're oil-related services, not cattle.
Well, you worked hard to get out of your town and to move to the city. Didn't you eventually move back to the town you
Well, I have a I have a home there, but I'm pretty much and I have a very nice home there, and I go there, and I have a bookstore there, which engages me a great deal. Building a million bookshop is a lot of fun. But of course, I also have a place, and I still have a place in Washington D.C. I have a little place in L.A. and a little place in Tucson. I have a kind of tri-coastal life, in a sense, and I've had it for a long time. I went to Washington, D.C. in 69, and since then, you know, I've been kind of all over the map. I get to Archer City a few days, maybe a week, a month, and live in my big house, and the rest of the time I'm either running bookstores in D.C. or Tucson, or I'm writing movies in Los Angeles or something. I don't just sit there.
You know, I was thinking maybe we'd end the interview with a song by your son James, who's a singer-songwriter. Do you have a favorite of his you'd like us to play?
Well, there's a song from the first album. There's a couple of songs from the first album that I like very much. Angeline is one. I think Angeline is a really lovely ballad. And there's a song about small town life called I'm Not From Here, I Just Live Here, that I think would be appropriate. Or the song called Level Land from the new album, Where'd You Hide the Body, would also be appropriate. Take your pick.
Did you bring him up as a single father?
Mostly, I did. Mostly not. I mean, that's a little exaggerated, because his mother, my former wife, got a doctorate in literature at Rice at the time when we were living in Houston. She just lived a couple of blocks away. So he saw a lot of his mom until and then strangely enough, when we moved east, Joe, his mother, got a teaching job at the University of Richmond, so she was even then less than 100 miles away. It wasn't like the first 7 years she just lived down the block, and he saw a lot of his mother. And then in the east, he still saw her every other weekend or something, but it is true that I brought him up, that he lived in my house and not hers.
Do you see his songs connected to your writing in any way?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think James is remarkable in that he's found a way to work that's not my way. That is, he's not a novelist. He's really more of a musician. But I think that the songs reflect a later stage of the same phenomenon. You know, the post, certainly the post-rural West, even the post-small town West, in a way. I think a lot of them are very good songs.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a very good talk.
Larry McMurtry's new novel is called Dead Man's Walk. He's currently making it into a miniseries. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.